Welcome to another Rock and Roll Walk of Fame and Shame presented by the City of Sydney. This is Hugh Liney, and today we're going to follow the rock and roll trail from the city centre through to Ultimo and Pyrmont. Some jazz aficionados strongly decry the closure of the old basement venue and its so-called radical move a few doors away at Circular Quay to its current site, with far better sound and visual access, may I say, in Macquarie Place, where it is now. Nevertheless, jazz eminence John Chan concedes, in quotes, "There have still been some unforgettable nights with Betty Carter, Mike Nock, Richard Thompson, Ten Part Invention, Jackie Ozarski, and so many more. Sydney's music scene would have been infinitely poorer without it." With the closure of the Harbourside Brasserie early in this millennium, and Soup Plus in George Street long gone by now, the basement remains preeminent in the northern reaches of downtown Sydney for its fine music of all genres and plenty of jazz too. Some nearby rock venues from the 80s that no longer remain but were very, very popular were the Governor's Pleasure at the Rocks and the Sydney Cove Tavern in the AMP Centre. Walking south on Pitt Street, King Street looms as the next street with a great musical heritage, but not surprisingly, not a plaque or a brick or even a cornice remains of great music industry sites like Albert Studios at 139 King Street or even Susie Wong's where the MLC Centre now stands. Little girl begin to think that she's grown. It was appropriate that one of Sydney's first venues to take style seriously was beneath the fashionista's favourite place to shop and stare, the Strand Arcade. Now, as the 80s progressed, or went on, and males and female fashion discovered a lot of colour again, and hair got bigger and taller, and romantics became newer, Strand had moved from being a simple below-ground punkish venue to quite a garish nighttime circus where hairdressers mixed with arcade workers and music industry types seamlessly merged with the fashion industry, all in the lights and shadows beneath the wonderfully unchanging Strand Arcade. Hoodoo guru Brad Shepherd remembers the various nights and sights at Stranded.
I remember Stranded being pretty much operating as a nightclub, and really the nightclub scene, contemporary nightclub scene now, seems to have stemmed, goes right back to Stranded then, you know, folks that split off in the tangent that would go to rock and roll shows and then became sort of enamored with dance music, if you will. You know, I remember hearing, that's the place where you would hear New Order's Blue Monday, you know. You would hear that at Stranded a lot. And as I recall, it was really a Sunday night was when we would perform there. And that was kind of more like the rock night, but they would, it seemed like the rest of the week, or certainly Friday and Saturday, dance music, a discotheque for what was hip, contemporary music. Oh, I have to go, but I'm
so tired of waking up tired. The lights are on, but there is... In George Street, south of Town Hall, it's a downward-sloping boulevard of demolished building and fast turnover developments, with very little to remind us of the southern CBD's once fecund music and dance history. Now, before the Regent Theatre was pulled down, late in the previous century, the Telegraph once splashed on their front cover, "Punk Riot at Regent." Now, apparently a few chairs had been thrown at an Elvis Costello concert, but our sources remain unconvinced whether the cause was Costello and the Attractions playing for not long enough, as reported, or for too long, as we suspect. The Trocadero, the city's number one glamour hall for singing, dancing and romancing, was visited by Hollywood royalty, real Anglo-Australian royalty, and most controversial at the time, the annual Bohemian Artists' Ball, where men dressed as women. A dozen Carmen Mirandas appeared one year, and sometimes vice versa. I suppose it's just a harbinger, really, for Sydney in decades to come. The Troc was where Hoyt's George Street has stood since 1971. But the Tivoli was in Castlereagh and burnt down and then rebirthed in the Haymarket and faded fast as rock and roll took hold. Another Tivoli did rise in Lower George Street beneath the cinema strip to become a really substantial rock venue for the best of local and overseas artists during the 80s and early 90s. It also closed as development issues took precedence for the owners. The Metro at 624 George Street remains one of Sydney's most popular gigs since the 90s. It says of itself that its artists have included Muse, Placebo, The Eels, Alex Lloyd, Damien Rice, Gomez, The Dandy Warhols, Eskimo Joe, The Hives and Beth Orton. Now that's variety. If the Chevron was glamorous and showy, then Checkers in Goulburn Street was the sophisticated centre of Sydney nightlife from the late 50s to the early 70s. It was run by the Wong family and attracted the cream of world entertainment like Liz Minnelli or Sammy Davis Jr. They performed for Australia's who's who of the period. Peter Bowden was security and doorman at the Trade Union Club for many years in the 80s, but he also remembers many other Sydney clubs very accurately, including great performances at Checkers Rugby Club.
I know Checkers quite well. I went there earlier. I saw the Four Tops there, saw Billy Preston, also saw Fraternity with Bon Scott down there. Great venue. I saw Carl Chisholm there and Jimmy Barnes threw the mic stand out into the audience and hit me on the head, but I was that inebriated it didn't make much difference anyway.
But as a rock venue, it continued for many more years with famous performances by AC/DC and Lobby Lloyd. In fact, Angus Young's quoted as saying, "We'd been together for about 2 weeks. We got up and blasted away. From the word go, it was great. Everyone thought we were a pack of loonies. Who's been feeding those kids bananas?" The Wongs also owned the nearby Mandarin Club, almost as famous as Checkers, but it was open 24 hours and therefore a real favourite with the entertainment industry, especially late night after their own performances. The neighbouring Goulburn Club was another favourite for Sydney's night owls and glitterati, notwithstanding that it was actually an illegal casino in the days when the word illegal had a more flexible definition. Across the road in Goulburn Street is the Civic Hotel, now a flash enough wining and dining venue in its own right. The Civic was a memorable rock venue as far back as the 70s, when subcultures like Teddy Boys, Mods and the rising punks would meet there. In the 80s, it was a well-known rock venue for many of Sydney's more popular bands on the rise, such as Mental as Anything or the Hoodoo Gurus. At the bottom of Goulburn Street in Chinatown is still the Sydney Entertainment Centre, whose future always seems to be under a cloud. Nonetheless, it's still there, revamped somewhat in recent years and still proving to be a fine auditorium for the world's big acts. Further venues of fame and shame at the southern end of the city included the Stage Door Tavern in Lower Castlereagh Street, where oversized, sweaty crowds would shout and scream to Chisel and the Oils. There was Gas Lash in Lower Elizabeth Street near Central, right next to the owner's Binky Burger store, which was undoubtedly an influential counterculture haven in the 60s, festooned by Martin Sharp designs and inhabited by folkies. The guitar legend John Robinson, who played there early in his career, described it as a dive of a joint, a coffee house. All sorts of substances were consumed there, said Robinson. Still visible, the building at least, is Rhubarb's, another subculture hang that itself has hung on for decades near the corner of Sussex and Liverpool streets. Music and media identity Chris Rule remembers many of the subcultures and the problems they caused around this area of town.
That was the era of the skinheads in Sydney. And it's funny because many years later I interviewed Graham Henry, Abbo Henry. We were talking about the old days of Sydney and he was saying how he was a skinhead. He used to be a skinhead. And there was a skinhead venue down in Central and it was called John Henry's. And the skinheads used to come up town and they used to have these fights, street fights, with all these English migrants who were basically the mods of the time. And Abbo Henry could actually remember this night at Rhubarb's, and I think I was there, I must have been about 14 when I was still at high school, and there was a pitch battle in the street, and all the skinheads came down with, you know, iron bars and stuff like that, and I can distinctly remember the guy who owned the club, Jim, I think his name was, who owned the Troubadour, standing in the front of the building with his head sort of all split open, and a couple of weeks after that, I think a young guy was actually kicked to death, coming out of Rhubarb's on the corner of George and Liverpool Street, and that kind of brought that whole sort of violent era to an end.
Oh, you may smile, sweet spirit on your cloud, knowing red light comes after the shroud.
Other venues that have disappeared entirely from one end of the city to the other include Beach Hut, Teen Canteen, The Bowl, Uptight, Beethoven's, Wardawson's Jungle, the St James Tavern, the New York Tavern, the Sussex Hotel, and far too many more. Sure, memories are never set in concrete. Of course, the Capitol and State Theatres remain as stalwarts of Sydney's entertainment precinct. Also down the central end of town is the Graphic Arts Club, where promoter Chris Rule ruled the roost in one of Sydney's top ever rock venues.
There were a lot of sort of new town bands and inner city bands like the Lighthouse Keepers, the Happy Hate Me Nots, the Johnnies used to play there quite regularly, Paul Kelly and the Coloured Girls were Rumpy Band. We had internationals like Billy Bragg. Had a lot of Melbourne bands play there, Big Pigs, Sacred Cowboys, SPK, Severed Heads. It was a real mixture of genres. But there was this band that came from the outer west of Sydney called No More Bandicoots. And they used to build these, they weren't particularly great musicians, but they used to build these incredibly elaborate sets. And on this particular night, they decided to build this big pirate boat ship on stage. And it was the only night that the manager of the club actually stayed back, because we used to get away with a lot of crazy things up there. And, you know, there was a night staff on that were fairly kind of relaxed. And this guy stayed back, and they kept saying, oh, he's coming up to see what's going on, you know. And this band had a reputation for doing sort of weird kind of things, you know. So they built this big pirate ship with these portholes along the front of the ship. And the climax of the act was that they stuck their bare bottoms through the portholes and got punters in the room to throw beer cans, empty beer cans at them. And right at this very moment, the guy who was the you know, president of the club, he walked in. So I had a lot of explaining to do the next day.
In Broadway, near the corner of Wattle Street, was a fine venue in the 70s called Jonathan's Disco, and it first became popular as one resident band, Sherbet, perhaps Australia's finest ever pop rock exponents, who honed their songwriting and performance skills there before going on to be creative and consistent chart toppers. Music writer and former editor of RAM, Anthony O'Grady, saw Sherbet at Jonathan's and watched them progress.
It was the making of Sherbet. Because he made them practice around about 3-4 hours a day. And as Clive said, you know, we thought we had enough practice under our belt. John didn't agree. If we didn't turn up for practice, then he'd fine us. And we had to add 3-4 songs a week to our repertoire. And we thought, well, you know, the repertoire works as it is. And John would say, no, you have to keep on adding things. You have to keep fresh, otherwise you can bugger off. And it all came to fruition when John Spooner. He started hiring big bands. He was doing good trade with Sherbet. Then he hired Jeff St. John, and it was built as the Battle of the Bands, you know. Jeff St. John, the great R&B star of Sydney, versus the upstart Sherbet, you know, coming from a pop background. Could they even share the same stage without shame? And as it turned out, Jeff took the stage half-baked. Did, you know, 35-minute version of St. James Infirmary, and, you know, went into a blues, and then Sherbet came out and did their killer set, absolutely wiped St. John off stage.
Later, Jonathan's became the Phoenician Club, very famous for Jeff Buckley in 1995, sadly infamous for the ecstasy-involved death of schoolgirl Anna Wood as well, but also very famous for a performance by Nirvana in 1992. Bruce Griffiths of Aberrant Records was there to see Nirvana in 1992.
It was full. It was definitely full. I was upstairs on the, there's a balcony around the, I think there might have even been two balconies, but I was on the first balcony. It was absolutely packed. I think there was more of a, the audience had more of a vibe than the band, in my opinion. I knew I was watching some sort of phenomenon, because what was on stage didn't really account for the reception. The energy, I'm assuming, Kurt tempered by heroin, that is just an assumption, but there wasn't massive energy coming off the stage. And I've seen footage of Nirvana where there is, and heard accounts of Nirvana gigs that were just amazing, but that particular night, that energy wasn't there, but the energy was in the audience.
Further along at 500 Wattle Street is the Vulcan, a tiny venue of the 80s and early 90s in particular, still powering along as a boutique hotel. Depending what night of the week, you might see the Celibate Rifles, the Happy Halfpenny Knots, even the Scientists, Rat Cap, or a combo of punk bands for entree, main course and dessert. In its prime, little effort was made to provide a comfortable or a very professional venue, but it was loud, it was close and warm, it was actually really, really good. Aberrant's Bruce Griffiths also remembers the Vulcan.
Celibate Rifles had a residency, again, I'm thinking Friday night, but someone else might go Saturday, but it was a weekend residency. And the Celibate Rifles nights were absolutely fantastic. They had, I guess, the Celibate Rifles audience, which was fun, not very, no hassles, that sort of thing. But then the night that they weren't playing tended to be sort of a punky night, which could mean, if it was the Happy Halfpenny-Knots, there would be a line of scooters out the front with all the mods that would turn up, and a sort of punks inside. But if it was someone like Chaos playing, it was probably a less enjoyable audience. Joyful Killing, some of those bands, once the skinheads were becoming a problem and bringing those people with them, not so nice. But certainly Happy Halfpenny Knots nights were always good. Rifles nights were wonderful. Just like so.
While Festival Records took many years to find its early feet as an Australian record manufacturer and distributor, there's common agreement that its two headquarters in Pyrmont coincided with its most successful days. Head office from 57 to 67 was at 223 to 229 Harris Street, Pyrmont, Rupert Murdoch buying the business from L.J. Hooker in 1960. With only a rudimentary studio at that address, they moved round the corner to the hard-to-miss Deco building in Miller Street, Pyrmont, on the corner of Bulwarra Road. The history of Festival Records is very much a history of Australian popular music and culture, and is captured in wonderful detail by Peter Cox of the Powerhouse Museum in his book Spinning Round, The Festival Records Story.
It was independent in its spirit, in its ethos. It was independent in that it had to go out and gain overseas labels. If they weren't giving it to it on a platter like they were, say, for EMI, for example, it had to go out and get them. And for a lot of these international independents, like, say, A&M is a good example, Ireland, there's so many of them, it was natural that they would look for someone to distribute them in this country who wasn't their competitor, in other markets. They needed someone they could align with. When the Miller Street building was under threat, or the studio was being closed, going to be sold, who knows what was going to happen to the building. And, you know, understandably, a lot of people who are aware of the heritage of the place tried to prevent this happening. They tried to get people like Peter Garrett involved in a campaign. The National Trust had a campaign saying that this building is a historic site. This is where Johnny O'Keefe recorded his hits. This is where the Bee Gees were. Wrong building. And it didn't advance the cause to have the facts wrong in that way.
The demise of Festival Records is as shameful as any story in Australian music history. It's a story of corporate neglect, personal empire building, and mad financial decisions. The handsome curved building remains, for always, we hope. But it's a reminder to passers-by of the truly golden days of Australian music. Thank you for listening to our podcast version of the Rock and Roll Walk of Fame and Shame from the City Centre through to Piermont and Ultimo. This series was produced by Frank Cottrell, Ashley Russell and Hugh Liney for GTI Media and presented by the City of Sydney. The producers wish to thank the many famous and infamous contributors who are listed in the accompanying map and notes for their recollections and their record collections. These productions celebrate the popular music history and the exciting cultural diversity of the City of Sydney.